This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I'd like to welcome everybody here to the Rathman Auditorium for a very happy and important occasion. It's always fun, honestly, to recognize the generosity of friends and to honor and recognize colleagues in the way that this event allows us to do. For those of you who I don't know personally, my name's Matt Terrell. I'm Dean of Engineering. I'm filling in for Steve Gaines, who would certainly be here, but for having to, unfortunately, attend a memorial service for a friend in Boston. We are kind of interchangeable parts in a way that science and engineering has worked very well together here over the last decade, a style certainly adopted by Martin Moskowitz and me. And I also want to recognize Martin here because he's really in large part responsible for many of the developments that are leading to this occasion. So the collaboration between engineering and science here is really a joy to work in and an extremely important part of this campus. We're really doing, and the people who are being honored and recognized here are helping us do something unique at the interface between biology and engineering. So it's somewhat appropriate, I think, to have an engineer giving these remarks. You know, I really, first of all, want to offer on behalf of science and engineering and myself personal appreciation to Gary and Sue Wilcox for having provided this generous gift for establishing the Wilcox Family Chair in Biotechnology. Let's do that. As I said, it really is a very cooperative joint effort spanning a large sector of the campus, and as will come out a little bit more in my remarks and certainly in Dan's inaugural lecture, there are some very special things going on here. If I turn to Dan, I would say, first off, Dan is not a guy who's worked in a field as much as has created a field. There's different names for it, but I would call it something like biomimetic material science, understanding how materials are made in nature and dissecting those mechanisms and then applying them to create new synthetic materials. And in that way, although Dan's appointment is in no official part in engineering, we certainly consider him an extremely important part of the engineering faculty and a contributor to the engineering faculty. So I don't want to go on too long because Dan is going to describe the field that he's worked in too. I realize I forgot one thing. Just remembered that I have two notes from people that couldn't be here that I want to read very briefly. You can see they're not too long. The first one is from Paul Hansma. Congratulations, Dan, on your appointment to the Wilcox Family Chair of Biotechnology. Your adventures at the interface between biotechnology and nanotechnology have been crucial in establishing and nourishing interdisciplinary work at UCSB. Your guidance and inspiration have lifted the level of research on our campus, and it's wonderfully appropriate to recognize your contributions and to celebrate the new opportunities that will be opened up through the generosity of Gary and Sue Wilcox. On a personal note, I want to thank you not only for your inspiration and guidance, but also for your friendship and your wonderful abilities to connect people together into successful collaborations. Thank you for making our campus a more exciting place to be. Your friend, Paul. And then, from Herb Waite, a personal note of appreciation and congratulations to Dan Morse on your appointment to the Wilcox Chair. Dan and I have shared many similar and parallel adventures in the area of marine biomolecular materials, a term he coined, especially during the years 1980 to 1998. I have the greatest esteem for his research and have been influenced by it in many ways. I've valued his attentiveness, clarity of mind, adaptability, and generosity. He remains an enormously important colleague in terms of his readiness to share his considerable research experience and facilities with others. Herb Waite. So. And now I'd like to turn the floor over to Chancellor Yang.
Good afternoon. This is a beautiful day. We have been celebrating the whole day since 8 o'clock this morning for the Foundation Trustees meeting. Now we have this is the moment I'm waiting for. We are here to celebrate very special four people here today. First, we are here to honor Gary and Sue Wilcox. We are also here to honor Dan Morse and Aileen Morse. Is Aileen? Aileen here. Yeah. You know, I have to first start from Aileen because Aileen is a renowned marine molecular biologist. So sometimes we forgot about that. I want to make a special note. Okay. After that, I also wanted to take this opportunity to acknowledge Dean Terrell and also our former dean, Martin Moskowitz. And Linda, you're here. Let's give you another applause to welcome you back. And also our executive vice chancellor, Gene Lucas, for all of your hard work. And we have all our administrative leaders are here, and Michael Withrow, vice chancellor, and Dean von Weizsäcker, and John Wyman, vice chancellor, and so many other trustees and chair professors and colleagues and friends. And I just feel this room is just filled with joy and honor today. We are actually here to celebrate the appointment of Professor Daniel Morse to the Wilcox Family Chair of Biotechnology. And we also, of course, are here to honor Gary and Sue. Now, let me first start from Gary and Sue. Gary and Sue are very, very special alum from this great institution because two of them have earned 6 degrees from this institution. Bachelor's, master's, and PhDs. And so along with their son, David, who is not here today, but John is here today. John, we also would like to honor you as well. And David is out in China doing a project for me. He and I talked about his great, he graduated from this TMP project program, and he was inspired to do a big project there to help with the obesity of that nation because they have this one-child policy that they have a problem there. All the child needs some care. And so you have a total of 7 degrees from UC Santa Barbara. And also another thing, I heard that you two met here while you were a student. Were you married here while you were students? Oh, let's give another applause for that celebration. And before I go on, I also wanted to read a special note. Matt read two letters. I have one short here. This is from your friend Steve Mandel and Barbara. He said, "My wife Barbara and I have been friends with Gary and Susan for over 20 years. A very important part of their life has been the creation of opportunities for others that might not exist without their help." So this is a very important message. The Wilcox Family Chair is a wonderful example of their lifelong commitment to helping others. I'm sorry I could not be here and wanted to thank them for all they have done. Gary has been a trustee for this institution, for our foundation trustee for a long time. And Gary and Sue always come whenever they have a chance, and they pay very special attention to our educational program. They share their academic vision, their vision biotechnology, as well as their financial generosity. They just so dedicated to this institution. We are very, very grateful to have you entrusted us with your generosity and vision for us to thrive. Thank you very much. And having said all of that, now it's time to recognize Dan Morse. And we honor Dan Morse today as the Wilcox Professor of Biotechnology. He is a founder of our graduate program in biomolecular science and engineering, and he is the director of the UCSB-led and also partnered with MIT and Caltech, this institute we call Institute for Collaborative Biotechnologies. And this center has been created for 4 years now, and I have attended just about every briefings I have. So after that, I got so inspired. One time I remember I went to give a keynote speech at the National Science Foundation sponsored international program. I just mentioned, I said, we have a center led by Professor Dan Morse, and I was so bio-inspired. So after I said what Dan has been done, the National Science Foundation now had some workshops, and they created a new program by four directorates, the director of MPS, Mathematical, Physical Science, and Engineering and Computer Science, and Civil and Mechanical Infrastructure, and Biology. By Jim Collins. They all got together to create a new program called Bio-Inspired Engineering Program. So Dan, you did not know you have such an impact. And let me start just to say a little bit about Dan. Dan received his bachelor's degree in biochemistry from Harvard and his PhD in molecular biology from Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And he conducted a postdoctoral studies in molecular genetics at Stanford. Dan was appointed as Silas Arnold Houghton Associate Professor of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics at Harvard Medical School prior to joining the faculty at UC Santa Barbara in 1972. Dan, as Dean Terrell has just described, Dan is a phenomenal researcher and has been recognized with many, many prestigious awards. Let me just name a few. He received a Career Development Award from the National Institute of Health. He received a Faculty Research Award from the American Cancer Society, a Distinguished Faculty Scholar by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Association, Visiting Professor in Japan, and a Visiting Professor at the University of Paris. And just 2 years ago, he was recognized one of the Scientific American 50, not 500, Scientific American 50, for outstanding technological leadership. So if you divide it by 50 states, you get one per state. It is more than just impressive. He is a Regents Fellow of the Smithsonian Institute and a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences and many, many more. And Dan is also a phenomenon teacher as well, and a mentor, and his students have also gone on to scientific prominence everywhere. We're just so proud of you, Dan. And today, you are not here to listen to me to speak. Dan will speak to you, to us, about adventures at the interface between biotechnology and nanotechnology. I always wonder, what is biotechnology? What is nanotechnology? Today, I'm going to get my answer. Thank you very much. And Dan, we look forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Dan. This is a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to see so many friends and colleagues here today. I want to thank you, Dean Terrell and Chancellor Yang. I'm deeply honored and humbled by this recognition and by your kind words. I also want to thank Drs. Gary and Sue Wilcox and their family for this honor, which is doubly special to me. Doubly special because Gary Wilcox has been one of my heroes for many years. Gary and Sue were graduate students at UCSB when I first got here, and Gary had just made a fundamental and momentous discovery, a discovery of a previously unanticipated mechanism by which cells turn on the genes that they need to have expressed. Gary's discovery and his elegant experimental proof of the mechanism that he discovered went so directly against the grain of all thinking in molecular biology at that time, it was truly revolutionary. It rocked that world. That discovery was so centrally important to our understanding of how genes work. A turning point so significant that I still teach it every year to my students. And central to the discovery I teach them is the unique creativity that Gary used in that discovery and that proof. Our connections extend even further. Gary's and Sue's son, David, who's not here today, while an undergraduate at UCSB, briefly explored a research project in coral biology with my wife, Aileen. That's the honor of the Wilcox Family Chair in Biotechnology is especially meaningful to me and to Aileen, and I'm deeply honored. I also want to take this opportunity to express my thanks to my department chairman, Professor Dennis Clegg, and to our recent Dean of Science, Martin Moskowitz, and the members of my department for all their encouragement and support that have made this possible. I want to thank the very wonderful students and postdoctorals, the outstanding and generous faculty, and the terrific staff with whom I've worked over the years here at UCSB. I also want to thank my wife, Aileen, with whom I've worked closely. All of you have made my research a continuing adventure. And finally, I want to thank all of you for sharing this celebration with us. The interface between biotechnology and nanotechnology that you've heard about has been an adventure for us and many of us in this room. What you see is an electron micrograph, a high-power electron micrograph of the shell of a diatom. This is a unicellular, single-cell alga, plant cell. There are tens of thousands of different kinds of these organisms in the oceans and fresh waters of the world. And the shell is made out of glass, silica. Biology builds these structures from silicon, the same silicon that drives our electronics, and oxygen. The structure here that you see is about 1/100th the diameter of a human hair. You can see the precision of nanoscale, that's ultra-small scale, architectural control over the formation of glass that this organism has used. You can see that this is an interlocking joint between the shells surrounding two cells. Here's another set of these interlocking joints. We don't have the ability to control structures on this scale in three dimensions yet. Furthermore, biology has accomplished this synthesis and fabrication under very gentle conditions, mild conditions, low temperatures, near neutral pH, no caustic chemicals. Very, very different from the conditions that we humans use in manufacturing materials of comparable structure, of comparable composition. And so for these reasons, the biological synthesis of such materials has captured the imagination of engineers, materials scientists, chemists, and physicists. And it's at the interface with biology that we've begun to learn how these syntheses are accomplished. The synthesis in biology of these materials is also remarkable just for the sheer scale. Gigatons per year of silica are made in biological organisms such as those diatoms in the ocean. And each year, many orders of magnitude more than the total anthropogenic manufacture. In fact, it's the fossil deposits of these those little shells that are mined as diatomaceous earth for industrial filtration and other uses. This is actually the world's largest diatomaceous earth mine. It's located just up the road in Lompoc and extends several kilometers deep. Millions of years of deposition of these organism shells in the ocean produced it. There are, as I said, tens of thousands of different species of these diatoms, and each species produces a uniquely architectured, remarkable structure of a shell, and every member of the species produces essentially the same structure. That tells us that they're genetically inherited and thus genetically encoded. We know, therefore, that the information directing the synthesis is encoded in the DNA, And thus, we're interested in the proteins that mediate this synthesis, because it's the proteins that carry out the instructions of the DNA blueprint. But in the world of chemistry, Voronkov, the pioneer in organosilicon chemistry, several years ago became fascinated by the similarity of the silicon atom to that of carbon. They both are about the same size, and they both have four valencies. He thought perhaps the biochemistry of carbon might help explain the biochemistry of silicon. I have to digress for a moment and say, I visited Voronkov in his institute in Irkutsk, Siberia, just a couple of years ago. Stalin had moved the entire institute to put the intellectuals on ice to Siberia from European Russia years ago. The chemists were pretty happy pretty quickly because they had their labs and they could keep going. The wives were still mad, I have to say. But Voronkov's notion that the explanation for the biological handling of silicon might lie in the chemistry of carbon, we found, didn't hold up. First, we could find no biologically formed silicon-carbon bonds. You'd expect that if errors would be made, if the two are similar, every once in a while a mistake would be made by an enzyme, and this kind of linkage, one would be incorporated in place of the other. But this has never been found. And even more disappointing, no alien life forms based on silicon have yet been found. The Trekkies in the audience will recognize the Horta, the... It was actually Voronkov who first suggested that perhaps life might evolve elsewhere and not as we know it, based on silicon rather than carbon. Instead, our analyses have found that the molecular mechanism of silica biosynthesis is based on its similarity to metals and the way biology handles metals. Instead of working with the diatoms directly, we turned to sponges because they offered a more tractable system for us experimentally. First, there's an equally remarkable diversity of structures made of silica, made of glass, by sponges. Some sponges make no mineral skeletons. Some make skeletons, little spicules or skeletal structures of calcium carbonate, some with glass. These are electron micrographs illustrating some of the diversity that we've found. This is a photograph of the skeleton of a deep sea sponge. It's about this high. We've removed the tissue that surrounds this structure, and you can see in close up that it looks as if it's made out of woven glass. It's quite remarkable, but it's actually not woven at all. But we found it's made from very simple building blocks that are secreted by cells, positioned by the cells, and then cemented together. First, to form an interlocking, overlapping, double quadrate lattice, as illustrated here. And then the cementing, you can see this glass cement that holds the elements together. But in order to get to the fundamental mechanism by which silica itself is made, we needed a simpler system that removed that three-dimensional complexity that I've shown you so far. We found this in a simple sponge that's located right offshore from our lab, little sponge that fits in the palm of your hand. If you dissolve the sponge, you're left with a handful of fiberglass needles that are 2 millimeters in length and about 30 microns in diameter. And about 75% of the weight of this sponge is glass needles. This turned out to be a remarkably tractable system that we could dissect, as Matt described, using the tools of biotechnology, as I'll explain in a moment. But the answers, the mechanisms we discovered, proved applicable far beyond the element of silicon alone. First, here's a cross-section through the sponge showing you these bundles of needles of glass that are produced by the organism as a kind of rudimentary skeleton. The sponges are amongst the simplest multicellular forms of life and the earliest evolved multicellular forms of life on the planet. And so here's a rudimentary skeletal system. If you disperse those, the needles look like this. And we found that running right down the center of each one of these needles of glass, there's an occluded protein filament. And we could dissolve the glass, purify the protein filaments, almost like a tangle of spaghetti if we dealt with millions of them, and then decode the structure of the protein. You do that these days by cloning the DNA that codes for the protein with techniques that Gary and his colleagues have pioneered over the years. It's possible to rapidly now read the sequence of DNA and then, using the genetic code, translate the sequence of nucleotides in the DNA chain to the corresponding sequence of amino acids in the polymer, the protein, that is encoded by that DNA. And when we did that, we discovered the protein sequence is one that we're familiar with already. The protein, we call it silicatine for silica protein, is highly homologous, very, very similar to members of a well-known family of enzymes. The highest homology that we found is actually to an enzyme called cathepsin that's a digestive enzyme found in the human intestine. Remarkable. Over 75% of the amino acids, point for point, are either identical, the solid lines, or biochemically interchangeable, the double dots, for one another in these two sequences. The conclusion is inescapable that these two proteins have evolved from a shared molecular ancestor. But over the millions of years that separate the human and the sponge in evolution, you would have expected that the sequence in the sponge would have diverged away from that of the ancestor, unless its function was required, was being selected. And in fact, we find that the amino acids that are responsible for the catalytic activity of the enzyme are present in the same position with no change in the silicatine protein in the sponge. This suggested for the first time in the 200 years of study of biomineralization that a protein found inside a biologically produced mineral might actually be functioning as an active enzyme, a catalyst, rather than just simply a passive template like a cookie cutter guiding the deposition of the mineral. We tested this hypothesis and found it's correct. If you strip away the glass from the protein filament, this is a high-resolution electron micrograph, there's considerable structure to this I don't have time to discuss, but we found that, sure enough, the surface of that protein filament is catalytically active. If we expose it to molecular precursor that can be hydrolyzed, chemically converted, first to an intermediate and then condensed to form glass or silica, sure enough, at neutral pH and low temperature, the molecular precursor is converted to glass nanoparticles, which bind to the protein filament. There are two activities here. The protein is active as a catalyst and also a template guiding the deposition of the newly formed glass. Well, realizing that the hydrolysis chemistry was similar to that which can be performed with metals, we realized that the silicon element, a metalloid or metal-like, it really would be representative of reactions that this protein could catalyze with a wide range of metal oxide precursors as well. And in fact, we found this is the case. We can use this protein for the catalytic synthesis and templating of a wide range of metal oxide semiconductors. Here you see the protein filament, the thing that looks like a tree in the background, and the newly deposited titanium dioxide, a technologically important metal oxide semiconductor that it has grown catalytically from a molecular precursor. Again, there's two activities that we found, the catalysis at neutral pH and low temperature. Normally, these reactions require high temperature and strong acid. You can see the templating effect because the metal oxide is the semiconductor is deposited on the surface of the protein. And with this approach, we've been able to make a wide range of interesting semiconductors.
In some cases, the metal oxide that's produced, like the gallium oxide, is highly crystalline. And in fact, the nanocrystals are deposited with an orientation along the fiber axis of the protein, suggesting that there really is an atomic level of coordination between templating, truly, between the protein surface and the growing semiconductor. In this case, we found that the gallium oxide that's made is a form that's normally made only at very high temperatures. Here, the protein's able to stabilize the growth of this form at 16 degrees centigrade, quite chilly. We use genetic engineering to probe those parts of the protein which we identified as required for catalysis, and they're illustrated here in green. This is a tracing of the three-dimensional structure of the ribbon diagram that we described, the backbone of the protein, and a few of the side chains projecting from the polymer backbone that are involved in the catalysis. Because we have the DNA cloned, and we can introduce changes at every point along the chain of DNA, and we know point for point the correspondence between the protein the DNA sequence and the protein sequence, we can interrogate every position in the protein to determine its requirement or its participation in catalysis. And with this approach, we found that, in fact, the three amino acids that are identified here are required for the catalysis of synthesis of silica glass from the molecular precursor that's shown here. And of these one, two, three side chains, these two are the most essential. If we knock them out, we knock out the catalytic activity. We understand how the catalysis works, but what about this templating that controls the deposition and the structure of the mineral crystals that are being formed? This is a space-filling model of the protein surface with the catalytic groups in green here. And notice this row of light blue side chains. These are the hydroxyl groups that we think might be involved in somehow coordinating with the growing metal oxide, forming a chemical bond to guide their deposition. If we imagine, or to do a three-dimensional computer modeling of the tiling of the subunits as they assemble to form that macroscopic protein filament, we can see that in some orientations, it's possible that the hydroxyls from one to the other can form from one subunit to the other to the other. These are individual protein subunits now forming the macroscopic protein filament, can form a kind of extended array that could help index or template the growing crystallites. And in fact, we're working now using X-ray diffraction data to get accurate pictures of the three-dimensional structure of the protein, and electron diffraction to tell us the crystallographic orientation of the metal oxide semiconductors that are made by the protein to determine the overlap, the exact overlap, and thus identify and confirm the identification of the templating groups. What's interesting in all this is that this low-temperature catalysis and templating of semiconductor synthesis that had never been seen before is mediated by a protein that is both a catalyst and a template. That's a design principle that I think is unique that biology is using. No other enzyme that I'm aware of, that the enzymes are catalysts, simultaneously serves as a template. To translate and test this and mechanism that we discovered to the kind of biomimetic material synthesis that Matt described, we began to make synthetic polymers, peptides and non-peptide polymers, that incorporate the kind of functionalities, those active groups that we identified as responsible for the catalytic mechanism, and found, sure enough, when we make synthetics, they also will self-assemble and catalyze the synthesis of structure-controlled silica or glass, or in some cases, semiconductors. Taking this a step further, getting away from the requirement for polymers, if we make self-assembled monolayers, take small molecules with those same functional groups that we identified by genetic engineering as required for the catalytic reaction in the protein, anchor them onto, in this case, gold nanoparticles, we found that just as in the enzyme, in the protein, it's the interface between those two different groups that is required for catalysis, either alone as inactive. And if we make substitutions, just like in the genetic engineering, we knock out the catalytic activity. Here you see the same approach, but now translated to a planar self-assembled monolayer. The protein model that we're working from is shown above. The essential groups identified as required in the natural protein now incorporated in self-assembled monolayers with the two different functionalities on the left and the right. These results again showed that it is the interface between them that's required for catalysis and helped us confirm the notion that it is the hydroxyl groups that are the templating groups. Thus, using this approach, we were able to use the self-assembled synthetic monolayers to catalytically write nanostructures of semiconductors on a silicon wafer. But our friends in electrical and computer engineering asked us, it's all well and good, but can you get rid of the carbon to make it, these materials useful for electronic applications? And so we tried to say, take a step back and say, okay, what have we really learned fundamentally? And it was two things that biology taught us. First, I didn't mention, but this enzyme is very, very slow in its catalysis of synthesis from the molecular precursor, providing an opportunity for what my esteemed friend and colleague Galen Stuckey taught me to appreciate as kinetic control of the reaction, providing the opportunity for the weak cooperative interactions of the growing nanocrystals of semiconductor with the protein surface to dominate and control the structure, allowing you to defeat the thermodynamic default and get crystal forms that you otherwise could not obtain at those low temperatures. Kinetic control, slow catalysis, we can do that in several ways fairly easily. But how do you get rid of the template? Well, a template, we realized, is just another means of vectorially controlling the growth of the crystal in space and in time, anisotropically structuring the reaction environment, if you will, imposing spatial constraint on the growth. And so this can be useful to regulate the kind of crystal, its orientation at an atomic level. We developed a generic approach to accomplish both of these things, as illustrated here. This is highly generic. I'll illustrate it just for the simple chemistry of the hydrolysis chemistry that was the basis of the silica and metal oxide formation. We start by diffusing a catalyst from the gas phase through the meniscus of a solution of a molecular precursor that must first be hydrolyzed before it can undergo condensation to form the network of either glass or metal oxide semiconductor. Because with the diffusion is slow and establishes a gradient, that vectorial control of increasing concentration, but is a function of space and time through the solution, we get the growth of metal oxide and hydroxide semiconductors without any organic template, no biochemicals, no polymers are needed. And if you look at the resulting material in three dimensions, here with a scanning electron microscope, you see that the nanocrystalline material that first started to grow at the meniscus then continues to grow sort of like rock candy, growing into a growth solution of the molecular precursor. And these are highly crystalline nanostructures projecting from the electronically conducting backplane of, in this case, cobalt hydroxide. Electron diffraction shows that these plates are highly crystalline. And in this way, we have found that this is a very generic method. We can make many novel materials that can't be made in such form by conventional high-temperature methods. As a result, we've been able to find novel properties in a number of them. So just to summarize, from the biology, from the biological mechanism, when translated into, let's say, pure chemistry, physics, and engineering, we have a new biologically inspired low temperature, very low cost synthesis from liquid of nanostructured semiconductor thin films, or in some cases nanoparticles. The method proved to be highly generic. We can make more than 40 different semiconductors using this method, many in forms that cannot be achieved with conventional high-temperature methods, and as a result, exhibiting useful properties, some of which we're exploiting or attempting to explore for potential applications. I'll illustrate just a few. For safe, high-power density batteries, for low-cost solar energy, uncooled infrared detectors, for automotive applications, flexible displays, and three-dimensional medical ultrasound. For example, because of the very high surface area of materials, metal oxides and phosphates that we can make this way that are potentially useful as lithium-ion battery electrodes, the lithium ion can gain very rapid access into the plates of the semiconductor and out again. That high flux rate of the lithium ion suggests to commercial partners here in Southern California that they would be useful for three-dimensional high-power density batteries such as needed for the next generation of hybrid electric vehicles. Similarly, the high surface area also proves useful for low-cost, higher-efficiency solar energy, and so we're pursuing that application as well. The same method, because it's so gentle, operating at low temperature and at near neutral pH, can preserve the relationship between two different metals that we build into a molecular precursor, so we can make uniquely highly crystalline, very small nanoparticles of bimetallic semiconductors in the family that are called ferroelectrics. You can see the nanoparticles here, and a cross-section through one of them shows the rows of atoms in this high-resolution transmission electron micrograph. This is barium titanate, a ferroelectric, and this method makes it possible to make the smallest nanoparticles of this material that have yet been obtained with very high purity. And we're exploring a wide range of potential applications of these potentially useful materials. For example, in the area of faster, smaller computer chips and magnetic memories. In order to get computer chips smaller, they've gone multi-layer. And to get them more and more condensed, to get more layers, it's necessary to shrink the distance between the computer chip layers and separate them so they don't short out with insulating material. Silica was the first that's used, but now to get closer packing, Intel and Sony are working with materials which have measures of insulation capability, as shown here. The barium titanate is even greater and offers potential applications here. And the material is also ferromagnetic and potentially useful for high-density ferroelectric random access memory, so you can get even more songs on your iPod. I don't know if that's a good thing. In the area, these materials also are piezoelectrically active, and so we're working with colleagues here, Professor Elliot Brown, Professor Hua Li, and their students, to attempt to develop conformal piezoelectric or acoustic pingers and detectors for tomographic, high-resolution medical ultrasound imaging, for low-cost infrared detectors for automotive applications, collaborating with the Aerospace Corporation and Raytheon. And a unique advantage of these materials is their possibility to provide a fireproof coating on the lithium-ion battery electrodes. We found that by doping these with a conductive metal and then sintering the particles to make a fine-grained ceramic, you see a 10,000-fold increase in electrical resistance as a function, just heating above 100 degrees. Very sharp increase in resistance. The thought is that if there's an incipient short in a battery and it starts to produce local heating on a microscopic scale, the material will suddenly become non-conducting because of the sudden activation of this resistance, and thus automatically cut out the electrical short. We know how important this is in view of the many, many millions now of batteries that have been recalled because of the fire and explosion threat. Let me close by telling you about one other area of work that we've turned to recently, in which we're looking at biology, and a different kind of biology, for inspiration, for new approaches to advanced materials. This is an octopus. It's an area of adaptive optical materials. This is an octopus, photographed underwater by my friend and colleague, Roger Hanlon, at the Woods Hole Marine Biological Lab. A second after Roger took this picture, the animal changed his appearance to look like this. He's still there. You can see the eye. He's changed his color, texture, and reflectance in different layers of the skin in response to neuronal control from the eyes to the brain to the skin. We're looking at the molecular mechanism by which the cells in the reflective layer are dynamically tuned. As you can see here in this microscopic picture of a few cells, they can change to reflect any color. These are related species of called cuttlefish. And same species, just in response to the neurotransmitter changing pattern. What we've discovered recently is that the molecular switch governing this change results in the activation of an enzyme that catalyzes the addition of phosphate groups onto a protein that is a key constituent in the reflective microscopic structures in those cells. We call those structures Bragg reflectors. And our hypothesis is that the phosphorylation of the protein changes its conformation and its hierarchical assembly, driving the condensation of these Bragg reflector plates and thus changing the optical properties. This is fundamentally different from present engineering solutions such as the zoom lens on our point-and-shoot cameras or more complicated MEMS-controlled Fabry-Perot filters for electrically driven tuning of optical devices. To get away from the weight and high power requirements, we're working with colleagues at Raytheon to attempt to translate what we've learned from biology into a polymer-based, dynamically tunable optical material which can be driven by weak electric currents. What you see different in the biological is that simultaneously the refractive index, the thickness and the spacing of the Bragg reflectors are changing, all three changing, giving an exponential increase in gain compared to the single modality of change in our present engineering approaches. The significance of the kind of work that our colleagues and I have been doing includes the fact that with the discoveries made by our students and postdocs, we've found previously unanticipated mechanisms that explain the enzymatic catalysis and templating of silica synthesis, a hierarchical assembly mechanism of proteins that provides a new understanding for the way in which genetic coding can lead to emergent properties in complex systems. I only touched obliquely on that today. And the possibility for understanding dynamically tunable photonic behavior. As a result, we've developed a novel biologically inspired low-temperature, low-cost generic method for semiconductor synthesis with a wide range of potential applications we're exploring with commercial partners in California. And most importantly, I think the exciting interdisciplinary approach that has been developed here at UCSB is generating not only new discoveries and industrial applications, but wonderful educational opportunities and excellent career opportunities for our students. With that, I want to close by thanking the students and postdocs and researchers in my present group, those who have been in the group recently and moved on but contributed to some of the work that I've described today, the terrific colleagues amongst the faculty here at UCSB with whom I've had the privilege of working over the past few years, and the funding agencies that have supported that work. With that, I'd like to thank you, too. Thanks. Thank you.
The public university continues to pay the salary of the faculty member, so the interest, a portion of the interest is available for the chairholder to use for research and so on. And so this is an extremely important aspect of retaining and honoring and attracting, and depending upon how we use it, really top-notch faculty. I'm also told that part of the tradition, and this is an old tradition of endowed chairs, is that there actually be a chair recognizing the chairholders. And we've extended it a little bit to not only the chairholders but the chair donors. So if I could ask Dan and Chancellor Yang and Gary and Sue to come up, we will make an official presentation of the chairs.
Go ahead.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not?
You can stand in the middle. That's a good picture.
Thank you. Thanks.
We haven't heard from the key players in this, and I'd like to invite Gary and Sue, one or both of you, to come up and address the audience.
Thank you very much, Matt, and I'd like to just thank this great university for the wonderful education that Sue and I received, also that our son David received while he was here. And it's that foundation that allowed us to go on and have the wonderful life that we've had together. And to be able to give back to UCSB is just very special for us. It's especially wonderful that Dan Morris is the first person to hold this chair. I remember very well when Dan came to Santa Barbara. It was just as I was finishing my PhD, and here was someone that was interested in gene control and how proteins touch DNA and control the expression of genes. And I think back on the wonderful conversations that I could have with him. And then as I continued to read his papers, it went from tryptophan repressor to serotonin, tryptophan being a precursor of serotonin and abalones. And as I continued to read his publications and the culmination of them in the talk that he gave today, it's just the most awesome and wonderful science, and I'm just so grateful that our paths crossed. I'd also like to thank my teachers, some of whom are here today in addition to Dan, the wonderful faculty of the biology department, my advisor, Alice Engelsberg, John Carbon, Ed Arias, Nancy Lee, and Dan, who taught me so much. And Sue had a similar experience in the economics department, and we're just so thrilled that her advisor, Walter Mead, is here today, and Thelma means an awful lot to us. And then finally, I'd just like to comment on what I think is the extraordinary importance of universities throughout the world. If we just look at the clothes we wear, the house we live in, the cars we drive in, the airplanes we fly in, the rockets that take people into space today, whether we look at the world from an Aristotelian point of view, like Dan showed us today, where you can just break things down into their components and then try and understand how they work when you put them back and build them up, or whether we take a more platonic view of the world like the humanities takes and ask how systems work and how people work and how individuals interact, everything that we know can be traced back to universities. And so I just would encourage all of you to remember how important universities are in our lives, how important they have been in the history of the world since universities were first invented back, I guess, somewhere in the 13th or 14th century. And whatever we can do to keep these shining lights that populate our planet burning brightly, and whatever we can do here in this room to keep one of the shiningest lights that's on a very beautiful setting here in the Pacific Ocean burning brightly, I encourage you all to think about doing. For us, it's we're just very privileged, and we feel very fortunate and very humbled that we have this opportunity. And I just thank UCSB for everything that they've done for our family. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.